multiple events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome to the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, doing this live thing every Friday evening, 7 to 9 p.m. Central my time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and whatever time it is, wherever you are, everybody all over the world can listen to this show live and even sometimes call in. At times, we do accept Skype callers, and that's what we're going to do during the second hour today. My guest will be Gordon Duff, senior editor at Veterans Today, where there's been a bit of a brouhaha about Jade Helm and various issues. And I've discussed these at some length and allowed Jim Fetzer, my co-host at False Flag Weekly News, to give his version. And we're going to bring on Gordon Duff in the second hour so he can take calls and fill us in on what he thinks is going on, not just at VT, but also around the world. Well, let's get down to business. Our first hour is, well, it's about the way the internet has opened up a whole new area of communication for people who are interested in finding out what's really going on in the world. And my guest is Patrick Henningsen. He's a writer, researcher, geopolitical analyst, and founder of the news website 21stcenturywire.com. 21stcenturywired.com is definitely one of the better alternative sites out there. It's apparently Europe-based, and I just got a great response from Patrick about this Garland, Texas apparent false flag. After I published a piece at Veterans Today about it, I saw that Patrick had put up, frankly, I hate to admit it, but an even better piece over 21st Century Wire. So let's hear about it. Welcome, Patrick. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you on. So tell me a little bit about what 21st Century Wire is and how you got started there.
Oh, 21st Century Wire, I started as a blog, WordPress site, but I was writing and submitting articles to a lot of other websites, you know, trying to get some stuff published. I was kind of relearning how to write, you know, de-educating myself from my state school, public school education, and relearning how to analyze and write. And after the Iraq War in 2003, I became, you know, really engaged in the issues in a much bigger way. And I was living in London at the time. And so I kept doing that. And I got frustrated because not everything I submitted would get published and stuff would just fall down the memory hole. So I finally downloaded a WordPress bit of software and just started blogging. And then in 2013, we transformed the blog into more of a news website, which is a lot more involved in the day-to-day maintenance of it and getting fresh content and getting writers to submit stuff to us as well. So, yeah, that's kind of how it got started. Humble beginnings.
Yeah, I think you've got one of the best news websites out there. You know, people who are interested in the alternative perspective on current events, you know, have a fairly limited number of really good news websites. There are all kinds of great blogs out there, but you know, I frequent What Really Happens, Citizens for Legitimate Government, and what Global Research, and of course Veterans Today, where I write, as well as the bigger international outlets like Russia Today and Press TV. So that's a good thing to be doing. What are some of the other sites that you like?
You mentioned a couple of them. I really like the work of Michelle Chofedovsky. I have done for many years at Global Research. And I do look at Mike Rivero's site. It's just, for years, it's just been an awesome resource. And there's a lot of evergreen articles on there, for instance, like stuff on encryption, on Operation Mockingbird, you know, that you can't find a lot of, you know, as you've probably been on the web for many years yourself, Kevin, you'll know that there's a lot of great material that has disappeared, especially between, say, 2001 and 2008, sites that just went offline. They literally disappeared, either because the person managing that site got burned out, got tired, or for whatever reason. A lot of information just, and then it just kind of reappears sometimes on other sites and also on YouTube and in video form. And so Mike Rivera's What Really Happened is just an awesome archive. And it's one of the few out there in the alternative media that has got such a huge tranche of information, but you don't have to wade through all the gobbledygook that you do on other so-called news websites that aren't really news. They're more like tabloid, sensational versions of the news. So, so those are, you know, some of the sites I go to. I go to about, say, a dozen sites that I go to, and I change. I change like the seasons. This time of year, I might be looking at some new stuff, and then I'll gravitate back to stuff I was looking at last year. So it changes all the time.
Yeah. I like to look at some of the sort of quasi pseudo alternative sites like Counterpunch, which has some good stuff. And then, you know, also some less good stuff. They've never really embraced 9/11 truth and some of the hardcore issues, but they have some good writers there. That's how I met Andrei Volchek. I believe in looking all over the place and sifting through all the information, not really trying to find one person who's totally reliable on everything. I don't think that exists. Mike Rivero is fantastic in so many ways. He has a great grasp of a lot of issues. He's archived his stuff really well, certain issues mm-hmm. like the dancing Israelis and things like that. He's got fantastic archives of, and he's got a sense of humor, which is really important, because when you're dealing with this material, if you can't laugh every now and then, you're going to go crazy. Mike also has these weird kinds of foibles that I would totally disagree with, like his take on the Pentagon. I don't buy. He seems to think all of us who haven't really seen the evidence for a big passenger plane hitting the Pentagon are a bunch of disinfo people. And frankly, I'm not a disinfo person, and I don't see any evidence that a big 757 hit the Pentagon. So there are things like that. Virtually everybody I'll disagree with about something. I think the bad guys want us to get wedged on these disagreements so that then we start fighting with each other. We can't work together. We can't get anything done. We waste all our time yapping at each other.
Oh, completely. And I don't want to go too far off on that tangent, but I will add to what you just said, that is a huge part of what I call consensus reality. So what you termed as the bad guys, or some people might call them the establishment, or some people might call them the New World Order or whatever, but they do rely on divide and conquer strategy. And that's especially true in the alternative media as any place. And I don't mind having political disagreements on with people or other pundits or writers, because you do every day in your day-to-day life, nor do I mind having technical disagreements about how some aspects of 9/11 went down, for instance. So I go to Counterpunch or antiwar.com, who has great geopolitical analysts and political commentators, but maybe they won't touch 9/11 or 7/7 or, you know, or Sandy Hook or Aurora or Garland, Texas. They just won't go there. And that's fine, because what they do well is great in-depth analysis and good, you know, sort of, you know, lateral thinking and a lot of different aspects of what's going on, let's say, in the Ukraine, Russia, the EU, Eurasia, and Africa, and other parts of the world. So you can't expect everybody to be reading from the identical hymn sheets all the time. And I think if people do, and they somehow want to start small little brush fire wars or sagebrush rebellions over stuff like that, it's very counterproductive in the grand scheme of things, which is that, you know, we do have to overcome and a lot of the lies and deception and misdirection and get close to the truth as we can.
Well, I would endorse all of that. I think at antiwar.com, I wonder whether Justin Raimondo, who's one of the main guys there, kind of got scared off of 9/11. He wrote a book about the Israeli spy angle, how Mossad agents were shadowing the alleged hijackers and running wild all over America. It was by far the biggest foreign espionage operation ever mounted against the United States during the year before 9/11. Mm-hmm. Obviously had something to do with 9/11. And he wrote a book about it. This was early on. I think he started with this stuff like still in 2001. I think his book came out in 2002.
Did that mention the Franklin, you know, that Franklin sting with the Israeli IPAC and the Israeli intelligence, the FBI busted some a spy ring. That was around 99.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, Justin, after he published, right after he put out that book, suddenly he had a heart attack, and he's a fairly young guy in pretty good shape. And so I think ever since then, you know, every once in a while, he'll make some comment about, we've been living in a bizarre world since 9/11, but he won't really, you know, flesh out what that means.
I don't blame, you know, I wouldn't blame him because, quite frankly, and you can probably attest to this, you've seen a lot of crazy stuff that, you know, our real world is sort of mimicking a C.S. Lewis novel at the moment, you know, or Lewis Carroll book, and it's just crazy.
I was thinking George Orwell, but yeah, I see that's your point.
George Orwell meets Lewis Carroll. I mean, crazy combination. So if someone gets spooked off of some of this stuff, especially if they're really close to it, I mean, look at some of the journalists that have not just been spooked, but they've been hit pretty hard by covering some of these other issues. For instance, like the NSA or all the whistleblowers and Jesslyn Radack, who had lost a child from it, you know, the stress of it and defending John Caraco and stuff like that. I mean, it's horrible to even comprehend that. So I don't blame anybody, whether they're spooked or not. I think this is really difficult material to cover on the best of days. So I'm not going to stand in judgment of anybody, whether they're in or out. But what I will say is that those who have stuck in the game, you know, whether they're not covering everyone's favorite pet issues, like anti-war has done some great work and continues to, and Counterpunch continues to do great work and will continue. And they have very intelligent writers. And so I think there's value there. Not everybody is willing to maybe jump into the deep end or down the rabbit hole on some of these issues. What we're going to discuss today is a perfect example. I scanned the media coverage about this so-called ISIS attack in Garland, Texas, and it's amazing to see the people who have just jumped right into line and salute, you know, goose-stepped their way right into the mainstream media's talking points on this issue, which is that we're a nation under threat, ISIS is in all 50 states, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not surprised. It's difficult because to basically get past that wall of denial, you have to acknowledge that there are things going on a clandestine level that are out of view, that are classified, that you do not have access or privy knowledge to, but goes on. And to think that it doesn't go on either in a foreign theater or domestic theater, or that there's no such thing as controlled opposition, then that is incredibly naive on one hand, but it's also intellectually or journalistically lazy not to want to get closer to that truth. And I think we have a security or secret state that, quite frankly, is probably bigger than the visible state. You know, we're getting to that sort of East Germany paradigm level where that which is hidden is almost probably, there's more people on the unofficial payroll than on the official payroll.
Yeah, it's kind of looking that way. That's what Gordon Duff, who's coming on in the second hour, always tells me. It's kind of weird, you know, we just had this big brouhaha at Veterans Today. And, you know, to me, it kind of looks like there's a lot of paranoia running rampant. You know, everybody seems so willing to believe that other people in the alternative media are on somebody's payroll. Probably a few of them are, for all I know, but it just seems to me that it's not worth even bothering to worry about it unless you have some kind of good reason to think so. But with this Garland, Texas thing, seems like when something like this happens, the typical response of people who should know better is often to just kind of buy the official line. And then one way to get people off of that official line is to point out historical stuff. Like I have a friend here in the Madison area who woke up to 9/11 after I started yapping about it in 2004 or so, but he still bought the official version of this. He's one of these left-wingers who believes in blowback, kind of wishes that Al-Qaeda really could blow up the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. And so he, once again, is like, oh, you're not denying that there's Islamic resistance, are you? This sort of thing whenever something like this happens. And I find that it's been helpful. Actually, I think I've brought him around on Charlie Hebdo now. And that was partly thanks to reminding him about Operation Gladio, which he either hadn't heard of or had forgotten about. And, you know, Operation Gladio was, that's been confirmed 7 ways from Sunday, that most of the big so-called leftist terror attacks during the Cold War were all run by the Pentagon through NATO. And that's not even controversial anymore by people who actually study history. So, you know, if all the big terror attacks then were false flag, why do we believe this stuff today? And people who are just getting the latest from the media, like the 5 seconds after it happens, they hear that there was a shooting in Garland, Texas, they just buy the official line. If they step back and survey the panorama of history and see that every major American war since the Mexican War has been launched by a big PR op, a fake enemy attack, and that all the big waves of terror, such as Operation Gladio, have been false flag, then you get that background, and it's a lot easier to put current events into context.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can't leave all that stuff out. Although it takes time to rake through. It takes time to order it. If you're putting together a discussion, or you're having a debate, or you're presenting this in a news format or anything, you do have to drag out this historical stuff in order to supply some context to what you're talking about now. So if you strip away all the history, if you strip away all this fact, if you strip away Operation Gladio, for instance, when you're talking about the Charlie Hebdo events, then really that's akin to, like, I don't know, you can come up with a metaphor to compare that to that's more pedestrian, but I mean, it's like you've got half the reality of it totally taken out. It's like a car without an engine. I mean, it's just not going to go. You can't go anywhere. You're just stuck. You're stuck with whatever has been constructed around you. And so I think the mainstream media does a very good job of ignoring history, that to make everything appear that is, if it's a grassroots, organic, just appeared on the scene. Oh, this is, oh my goodness, what are we going to do about this? Oh, we don't know what this is, but we do know what this is. We know what ISIS is. We can trace the lineage of ISIS right back into, like, different points in history from Zbigniew Brzezinski in 1979, we can go back further to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is probably more your area of expertise, is to, you know, how the Muslim Brotherhood came to be and how it was used as a tool by British intelligence and other intelligence agencies as well, and used to manipulate political things in that region and to change the course of history. That's what Gladio did. It changed the course of political history in Europe. That's what Gladio's objective was, and it succeeded to a degree at that time. But so that's what ISIS is today. It's mm-hmm. To me, it's the exact same thing.
Yeah, I would largely agree, although I think there are nuances with the history of the Muslim Brotherhood that sometimes people miss, and with these other issues as well. But, you know, along with the historical analysis, it's also helpful to go over this, not only just so, you know, we can understand what's happening today, but also from a rhetorical perspective, when we're talking to people who are really not fully paying attention or maybe not that cognizant of history. And, you know, we need to find an entry way to get them this notion that maybe what happened in Garland, Texas wasn't what you're being told. People will tell you that if you want to get new information to people, often hitting people with radically novel, disturbing information just out of nowhere doesn't work. They just shut down and they dismiss you. But if you get them nodding along with you, then if they've said, yeah, 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 like, you know, 5 or 10 times, then you hit them with the new information and it kind of fits in with all the things that they were agreeing with you about. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, if you go through all of the big false flags and war trigger events that launched all of America's big wars since the Mexican War. You just take it, you know, from the Mexican War to the USS Maine, to the Lusitania, to Pearl Harbor, to the Gulf of Tonkin, to Operation Northwoods, to the Kuwaiti incubator babies, and then finally you get to 9/11. It's easy to get them nodding along with these earlier things because they're not so threatening. You know, anything that's far away in time and space is not threatening. And people know this. The cover-up artists know this. Stanley Fish, for example, who wrote a big op-ed blast against me in the New York Times, said that professors shouldn't teach about this, you know, this new stuff, especially controversial positions. Anything that's recent shouldn't even be touched by the academy. And the reason he said that, of course, is because it's sensitive. The recent stuff is politically sensitive. The old historical stuff, less so. So it's not so sensitive. So you can go through it and people nod along. Oh, yeah, I kind of remember hearing that Abraham Lincoln said the Mexican War was started by a false flag. And yeah, I remember hearing this about the Maine and the Lusitania and Pearl Harbor. So you get them nodding along. Then by the time you get to 9/11, they see that, well, if every other war was started this way, why wouldn't 9/11 have been also? And so that's helpful. And also, I think other countries going off, like Operation Gladio doesn't freak Americans out that much, even though it was their tax dollars that paid for it, because it killed Europeans, not Americans. For some reason, people are not that disturbed when their government goes out and slaughters people elsewhere in the world. But if they're slaughtering us, American citizens, oh my goodness, that's so terrible. Like, we don't care that they killed 60 million people since World War II in CIA interventions in foreign wars, according to Chomsky and Volchek in their book on Western terrorism. That doesn't matter. But if they would kill a few thousand Americans to start a huge war, that would be unacceptable. It's unthinkable. We can't go there. You know, so geographical distance is good, too. The Charlie Hebdo thing has been great. You know, my Charlie Hebdo book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, is doing really well. And I'm getting into audiences here in the U.S. that would never accept me for 9/11 talks, like mosques. For example, the mosques here are open to hearing about Charlie Hebdo because they're not terrorized. If I talk about 9/11 in the mosque, they're going to throw me out. Like, they're afraid that the FBI is going to come and take everybody to Guantanamo if I talk about 9/11. So if I talk about Charlie Hebdo, that happened over in France. And, you know, we're in the United States. We have an ocean between us, so that's not so bad. So getting a little distance, getting people nodding along, and then bringing up the really hardcore stuff, I think, is a good strategy rhetorically.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of similarities that are pretty too obvious not to compare with the Garland, Texas event with Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, yeah, talk about this.
Well, one of them is... just aside from the fact that both events involved the cartoons or art depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. Okay, just put that off to the side for a minute, and let's look at the similarities. We have two gunmen at Charlie Hebdo. We have two gunmen who we never saw. No one ever saw on the scene at Garland, Texas, except for the police. So they're the only witnesses. Both of them have gunmen. Both of them, the gunmen are dead. There's no story to be extracted from them. The story was constructed after the fact. And also, in both cases, the so-called first two gunmen were under, or at least one of them in each case, was under long-term surveillance by the security services in France, the French Special Branch Police, and in United States, it would have been the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So that is another amazing coincidence. And in both cases, they were allowed to run and plan their operation and then go to the venue itself at the time of the event. And in the case of the Garland, Texas shooting, they were shot dead. I don't even think they got out of their car. I think there was a couple hundred rounds pumped into a black sedan. And they were allegedly shot in the head by a security guard from the school district and not even the SWAT team, which was pre-positioned. And so Garland, Texas is even more outrageous in terms of a plausible official story than even Charlie Hebdo was. And Charlie Hebdo, he had a magazine having an editorial meeting at 9 in the morning or whenever it was, a gunman appear. And as implausible as the scene that ensued after that with Charlie Hebdo was, this Garland, Texas thing was completely compartmentalized. All the attendees of this event, organized by a very political character named Pamela Geller, and she's a instigator, I would call her. She's
I'd call her a Zionist genocide propagandist.
Yeah, you could say too. She's definitely in that category as well. But everybody there was out of state. All the attendees, 200 attendees to that event, were from either out of town or I believe out of state, and they were compartmentalized there in a secure area. That the gunmen might have arrived, if they did in fact arrive, they would have arrived maybe even not knowing there was an event inside. They could have been on a drill. They could have said it's a bank robbery. Who knows? But the point is, they won't be able to tell their story. Now, that might seem outrageous. That how could, is it possible that if one of them, it turns out, has a handler, has a confidential informant who's paid $126,000 to manage and to lead this person. We see that quite frequently. Now, this is a good entry point for someone who maybe is skeptical about this event. So would the FBI actually hold someone by the hand with a confidential informant, undercover person, hold a and groom a terrorist, train them, maybe even radicalize them, who knows, and then actually direct them to the point where the event is happening, where they might meet their demise or they might be arrested? Has that ever happened before in U.S. history? And of course, yes, it has. The 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the FBI allowed the terrorists to detonate the bomb. They even supplied most of the material in that operation, including the vehicle, I believe. So they just let it happen. So that was a big one. But there's been small ones. The Ottawa shooter, which was just last October, he was also under surveillance. He was on a no-fly list. His ID had been confiscated. Tamerlan Tsarnaev of the Boston bombing was recruited by the FBI. That's admitted as far as we can see. We also have the underwear bomber who managed to board a plane in Amsterdam without any identifications, but had an escort or a government person with him. Could have been his handler. And we have Buford Rogers, another one in America. That was 2013. Jared Miller, Las Vegas shooter, was also working with the police in advance of his shooting spree as a quote-unquote witness with the Clark County Sheriff's Department, I believe. And we have Naji Mansour, and Kwasi Mohammed Nafis, the Christmas tree bomber as well, Mohammed Osman Mohammed, and Timothy McVeigh. You could even talk about his relationship or Elohim City with the FBI. So, and there's others. There's the two women from Brooklyn that were just busted in April. They had an informant who worked with them, and you see this pattern over and over. And so you have to, any logical person, any rational person has to ask the question. If you don't ask the following question, then you're being absolutely disingenuous, in my opinion, which is that, is it possible? Is it even possible that none of these would have happened if not for the FBI?
Yeah, it does look like in so many of these cases, the patsies are groomed by FBI, intelligence agencies, police agencies. And you know, we do see that with Charlie Hebdo. The two brothers that they ended up blaming for Charlie Hebdo were busted for child pornography a few years earlier, and then that case was made to go away, which suggests that they must have become informants. And then they were set up as traveling back and forth to Yemen, which suggests that either they were actually traveling, or perhaps more likely they were just having their passports stamped as the legend was being constructed. I think the folks who organize these kinds of events presumably have a kind of a reward system where they perhaps tell the patsies that, well, please, you have to do this and do that, and this is a drill, you're going to be paid X amount of money. And con artists know very well that when you offer people a bunch of money for doing something pretty easy, maybe kind of exciting, they'll usually go for it. In fact, people will do incredibly stupid things if you dangle a bunch of money in front of their nose. Every Nigerian scammer apparently knows that. They must be getting people to fall for those Nigerian scams. They're still sending out emails. So the informants, the FBI people know this, and I think they're often getting folks to run drug errands for them, to do drills for them. The alleged 9/11 hijackers, for example, were totally surveilled by Able Danger. They were running drugs for some CIA-linked drug smugglers in Florida, and they were probably being told that they were drilling, you know, participating in some kind of drill. And in many other cases, we know that people have been manipulated by being told that they're part of a drill. And some think that the London bombers were set up by being hired to be part of a drill.
Well, that's absolutely true, Kevin. And I remember I was in London when that happened. And I remember watching the media reports as they came out live. And two men were shot at Canary Wharf trying to enter the offices of a major national newspaper at the ground level lobby. And they were said at that time to be two of the terrorists. So clearly what appears to be absolutely the case is that the 7/7 bombers were on a drill and they made a run for the media when they found out that they were supposed to have blown themselves up for whatever reason, and they didn't. And we have evidence that the bombs were pre-positioned, one below the carriage of London Underground train at King's Cross, and some other similar evidence. So that is a pretty obvious one, running a drill on the same day. It so happens the security services in a private firm led by Peter Power, Pfizer Consultants, I believe was their name, running a drill involving 1,000 people in the city of London about a series of terrorist attacks that morning, hitting the exact same targets. What are the odds of that? Well, you know, we don't have enough zeros to calculate those odds. But that that's not been accepted as consensus reality, unfortunately, because consensus reality is determined by the validation of papers of record, for instance, newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, maybe WikiLeaks now could also provide validation. But in terms of the press, it's the mainstream media still, except for maybe a few exceptions in history, like the Monica Lewinsky scandal being broken by the Drudge Report. But still, it was validated by the mainstream media. And until one of these events in 20 or 30 years, like Gladio, is finally validated by some mainstream media outlet or some paper of record or Seymour Hersh, then it's going to continue to swirl around in the behind the scenes in the sort of alternate media. So this is a big problem.
How do you think they keep it out of the mainstream media? Because there are times when it starts to cross over into the mainstream. You know, there are these obvious sort of embarrassments and leaks that get into the mainstream, and then they typically sort of get consigned to the memory hole. For example, right after 9/11, Mohammed Haykal, the Arab world's leading political commentator, got on Al Jazeera and said, "This is ridiculous. When I worked for the Egyptian government, we totally infiltrated so-called Al-Qaeda, as did many other countries. Al-Qaeda was just a cat's paw for intelligence agencies and couldn't have done anything themselves, much less blown up these buildings." And likewise, over in Pakistan, General Hamid Gul stood up and said in the international media, "This was a false flag. It was run by Israel and their friends, the Christian Zionists in the U.S. Air Force and people in this administration." And that got reported as pretty big news, actually, as I recall, at the time in the international mainstream media. There are all sorts of these kinds of sort of leaks and slip-ups. The New York Times reporting that the greatest mystery of 9/11 is that the steel from World Trade Center 7 was not only melted by something, but it was actually vaporized. So many of these things slip into the mainstream media, and then they get kind of just, they become taboo and nobody goes there anymore in the mainstream. And you have to wonder sort of how that works. If you're a reporter for the mainstream media, you've reported on the vaporization of World Trade Center steel or on what somebody like Hamid Gul or Mohammed Haykal has said, how do they prevent you from following up on it?
I think there's systematic institutional systems that are in place, and they're not just new, they're generational. And one of them is an old thing called peer pressure. And you work in academia, Kevin, so you would know what that means to other academics. I've seen people's careers get ended for publishing papers on certain topics, like geoengineering, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they've been blackballed from their own institution or forced into maybe an adjunct professor position or lost their tenure or didn't get their tenure or whatever. But real risky moves, you know, ballsy moves. Can you make those moves in media? I think the system is gamed for a consensus reality system whereby you will have to toe the line. Otherwise, you will get fired and, you know, go along. That seems to be, there's control in place, and it's money. You've got money, and besides that, if the money doesn't work, then you can fire the person or then threaten them or ruin their life in the case of other journalists that have been, blackballed, for instance. I mean, it happens in everything. It happens in Hollywood. You take a political stance in Hollywood, you got blackballed. I remember talking to Ed Asner about this. You know, that's the way it is, or it was with the labor unions, you know, back in the 80s. And in media, it's the same thing. You will not survive. Don't think you're going to have that position at the New York Times or have that editorial position at the Washington Post or be a syndicated columnist. You will not have those jobs. You will not earn the money and the kudos and being invited to panel discussions and touring around the world in some cases, publishing books, having a nice life. Okay. Nice house, two cars, two garages, you know, 2.5 kids and a boat in the Hamptons or whatever it is that your thing is, you know, or have a, like, I won't mention any names, but a house in Telluride, Colorado, a house in Newport Beach and a house in Newport News, you know. So if you be a nice television personality, expert or pundit or whatever. So, it, you know, why would you not want to have those things? And then also serve your country. If you're working with the intelligence agencies or you get summoned to private meetings and you have your sources, quote unquote, sources in the CIA or the NSA or the Pentagon, they bring you to lunch. They tell you what's going on. Oh, don't know. That's not happening there. But this is what's really happening here. But this is a secret. We're only telling you because we like the work that you do. And we trust you. We don't trust those other guys. No. They're savages, but we like you and we're giving you this. This is a scoop. And then you develop that deep throat relationship. And some people make their whole careers out of those deep throat relationships. And that deep throat's feeding them like the mushroom principle. They're feeding them, you know what, and keeping them in the dark the whole time. And then that gets played out in the media. And you, if you watch CNN, they say, we're working our sources. What are your sources saying, Wolf? What are your sources saying? Well, my sources said, I just spoke to, during Charlie Hebdo, that's what they did for 48 straight hours. They said, Paul Cruikshank or one of their terror experts would say, I've just spoken to a senior source in French intelligence, unnamed source. And that's no good. That's no good for me as a news consumer. I want names. I want someone to own that. I want an official person to say it's no good for you just to say that you spoke to someone who spoke to someone in this department and then say that that's somehow fact, that there's some terrorist epidemic going on throughout Europe. I mean, we could very easily be lied to in that sort of sloppy system. And that's the system we have. That is what we have in terms of mainstream media. That sets the news agenda, that says what's real, that is our reality. That is consensus reality. The most amount of people will agree that that's the consensus, that that happened, that 9/11 happened this way or Charlie Hebdo happened that way. And end of discussion. If you want to go against swim upstream on that or go against the grain, you're going to be in for a hell of a fight or you'll be ostracized or ignored. End of story. So that is, and forget about the politicians questioning that. I mean, once in a blue moon, you might find that with Cynthia McKinney or someone who's really, really brave and who doesn't care and, you know, who doesn't want to have a Secret Service detail for the rest of their life. They'll speak up about that. Once in a lifetime, you'll get somebody, but that's it.
Yeah, it does seem pretty much that way. Well, I think they're maintaining a certain narrative and people almost unconsciously know that they have to report what's going to sustain the overall official narrative. Right now, the official narrative is we have this horrible problem with radical Muslims. So yeah. Everything has to be interpreted that way. And of course, there is no such problem. You know, terrorism in the United States kills fewer people than lightning strikes, bathtub drownings, and it's not even a statistically significant threat. You know, we lose a 9/11's worth of people every 2 days from cigarettes and every 30 days from automobiles. But the fiction that there's this huge threat from those terrorizing radical Muslims has to be maintained. And so each time anything happens, rather than looking at it rationally and saying who's gaining from this, instead they just kind of automatically rubber stamp the official narrative.
Let me just throw this in too, Kevin, because time, to me, I look at timing as one of the things I always look at. To me, timing is everything. And there's so much stuff happening so fast. It's hard to keep up with. But for instance, I'll give you an example. The Patriot Act, or at least important parts of the provisions within the Patriot Act, are due to expire in the next couple of weeks. And lo and behold, what do we have this week? A so-called ISIS attack on U.S. soil. And then what do we have as well? The U.S. military has raised its threat level to Bravo level and believes now they're recycling the story which appeared in March about 100 military names leaked to the media or leaked on the internet by some ISIS British hacker, okay, who himself has spent time in jail and is most likely rolled as an informant while he was in jail. But that's a whole nother story.
Is this a bizarre story? Like, why would leaking military names really make any difference? I mean, if you want to go shoot some military guys, it's pretty, you know, go down to your VFW hall or whatever.
I mean, how would you get that information to know who all these people who supposedly worked on the first round of airstrikes against ISIS back in, I think, whenever it was? How would you get those? I mean, clearly, you could put any names up. I mean, are we validating all these names? Are they really military names? Are they really frontline infantry or pilots or whatever? It's just anyone can make stuff up on the internet, including tweets by the shooters or the bombers or the terrorists themselves. And the whole story is pinned down by and predicated on Twitter tweets. This thing in Garland, Texas. Mm-hmm. That's the big proof. That's the smoking gun. Tweets. Anyone can create a Twitter account. And I personally don't buy the story that these guys were able to, while they were driving up at whatever speed they were driving up, getting ready to burst out of their car in body armor and guns, all guns blazing, that they had time at that minute to tweet Allah Akbar, whatever it was, Sharia of Light. I just don't buy that as a logical person. So we have that problem. Plus we have a few other glaring, obvious problems with this story that if you just start picking it apart and you look at, you know, what are the odds that Pamela Geller, who would spend $50,000 on an event, spend $10,000 on a SWAT team, special ops team, by the way, most likely could be from Kraft International in Dallas, Texas. I don't know. And the school district and the mayor would be okay with that. We're going to have 40 officers in total, armed officers, securing the perimeter of a school in your small town. I mean, isn't that, if you thought it was that dangerous that it requires that much security, then wouldn't you think you'd be putting the community at some kind of risk? And then this would sort of become a problem in terms of a risk assessment. So, and the mayor says, no, we believe in our constitution. And then when I hear that, I knew that there was some sort of a fix going on because I just don't know anybody who thinks like that in the real world, unless they know that nothing's going to happen or they know that this is part of a drill. Then they'll say whatever they want to say. And everyone's posing for pictures with all these marksmen at the venue after the so-called big terror scare. They're all posing for smiley pictures, and these guys don't look stressed out at all. It's just like kind of a nice day out, nice press junket. And then everyone's singing God Bless America, waving a flag afterwards in the auditorium. I mean, it's too much.
Yeah. It has that scripted feel all the way around. Yeah. This kind of security that they bring. Pam Geller spends like $10,000 plus or however, whatever it was on this massive security. And a lot of these people are like that. You know, the anti-Islam provocateurs seem to run around with their own private army. I mean, I don't really see a whole lot of realistic threat against them. You know, where somebody like me, I've been like, you know, abused by Fox News. I had Lynn Cheney's group ACTA put out basically a hit list, a hit piece on me urging folks to email me at my University of Wisconsin email and abuse me. And so I had dozens and dozens and dozens of death threats from, they're all full of misspelled words, so I wasn't exactly worried. But, I've been running around with zero security, you know, talking about 9/11 truth and all this stuff, you know, which is supposedly so unpopular. And they're whipping up hate constantly on Fox and throughout the whole mainstream against people like me. And I just run around doing these events and, you know, the state legislature, or the ringleader of the witch hunters, Steve Nass, had a pray-in against me at my talk at University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, which of course made the event sell out in 5 minutes. All the tickets were instantly gone when they heard that there was a pray-in. So there's all this kind of crazy controversy I've been involved in, and not once have I ever had a single bit of security anywhere. I've gone zero. And so it just seems weird to me that these crazies, you know, Pam Geller and these other Islamophobe crazies who you know, they're creating the illusion that they're under threat because of what they're doing, when there really is no realistic threat. And I figured this out early on, that 9/11 was designed to terrorize people and put them in a state of fear. And I quickly realized that if I just let go of the fear and did exactly what felt right and told the truth, regardless of, you know, how threatening it would be for other people, sometimes they would feel fear, but, you know, I didn't have to. And I was walking, feel like I'm walking through a crowd of fear lobotomized zombies. It's like the whole nation is just a giant herd of fear lobotomized zombies.
Sure. It's not, you have to look at these events. If you're a journalist or you're a writer or you're a researcher or you're an analyst, you can't look at them as some sort of cataclysmic event. You have to look at them as crime scenes. It's like CSI. It's like an episode of CSI. That's all it is. It's a crime. If someone was shot, someone wasn't shot and it was a terror scare. But if someone in some federal agency is involved with staging an event to make it look like a terror event, well, that should be a crime. But we're not sure in America whether that's legal or not because of, let's say, the repealing of the Smith-Mundt Act, for instance, which banned propaganda aimed at a U.S. domestic audience. That was repealed, so now it's legal. So is this part of a Smith-Mundt-type operation? It's very hard to tell. All I can tell you is that this is not a level playing field. Okay, because let's take Pamela Geller, for instance. She's fronting a few organizations that have 501c3 status. One of them is Stop the Islamization of America. Now, a lot of money gets laundered through those types of organizations, and maybe some of that money ends up to stage events like we saw in Garland, Texas. Now, what if someone else started a charity called the Stop the Jewification of America, for instance? How long would that organization last? Would that fall foul of hate speech laws or hate crime laws or something like that? And funny enough, Kevin, this is I knew something was fishy here because I find myself agreeing with the Southern Poverty Law Center on this, who are normally very over the top on some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But and kind of do a good job in covering for the FBI in a lot of cases. But they came out lashing at Pamela Geller, as did many others, as being a complete provocateur. So when you see weird ripples like this going on, political ripples, so Pamela Geller is like, she's the new Terry Jones, but she's a lot more dangerous because she created a theater here that is a 360-degree theater, which to me is totally contrived, but is in a real – it's one thing for Terry Jones to be burning Qurans, okay, because he's an evangelical preacher. She is an Israeli lobbyist, and it's a whole nother – has a whole nother political dimension for her to be involved with this. And the publicity that was spun from it was a perfectly woven story. They appeared at the right time, the two shooters. They were gunned down by this brave security officer. And don't mess with us in Texas because we're armed to the teeth. And then so everyone can get it. And even, you know, the gun control people came in and complained that these guys got a hold of firearms. So everyone got a little piece of the action on this Garland event, which I thought was amazing. So it's just... And Geert Wilders, you know, they even brought Geert Wilders in from Holland, who is a complete comical clown-like character in Europe, but somehow now lauded. He'll be touring, doing Tea Party paid speaking engagements for the rest of his life now after this Garland event. So there's a lot of people who can profit from this. There's a huge economy in this fear. It's the fear economy. It's huge. And it's there's a media... There's a whole media economy that's predicated on pumping fear, scaring people, and it's a lot of people getting rich off it. There's a lot of people making an absolute fortune out of it.
Well, that's right. It's funny how it's been following the same script Charlie Hebdo followed the same script as the Mohamed Merah shooting a couple of years earlier. there were two separate attacks. One was on the national symbol, and in that case, it was on French soldiers, followed by an attack on a Jewish target, a Jewish school shooting. And of course, the bodies were never seen. The excuse was that under Jewish law, they couldn't do autopsies, so they were quickly hustled off to Israel to be buried as national heroes, but nobody ever saw the bodies. So there was that. So we have a national target and a Jewish target. Then we have Charlie Hebdo, same thing. National target is French free speech, and the Jewish target, of course, was the kosher deli. And in Garland, Texas, seems like it's kind of following that, in that we have an attack on free speech, which is a national target. And, of course, ISIS is the enemy of America. And then we also have simultaneously an attack on Jewish Zionist targets, which is, in this case, Pam Geller, who's a Zionist lobbyist and a Jew. So it seems like the talking point is that the Muslims hate our freedom and Jews, and that freedom and Jews go together, and that good patriotic Westerners have to stand up for freedom and Jewish Zionists by basically going off and killing lots of Muslims.
Yeah, and that that we're doing this because it's the Constitution, and you hear this when you see the U.S. Constitution being used as a battering ram, a political battering ram in this fashion. Because I have to step in at this point and saying, well, that's not how I interpret the Constitution. You don't you create a provocateuring situation where you're whether it's real or not, whether it's a false flag or it's a real terrorist attack, you don't bait violence. And this to me is like this kind of ugly Americanism that is starting to emerge right now, with this event encapsulates that whole, sort of trend. And it's that we need to, the speech that's unpopular, we need to, you hear Megyn Kelly was just out of her chair the other night saying we need to defend that extra. The more offensive it is, well, hold on for a minute. Let's talk about free speech for a minute. Some free speech is okay, worth defending in this country, and others is not. Chapel Hill, North Carolina, only recently, some students were basically threatened or facing huge penalties for displaying a Confederate flag. Okay, that's free speech, right? No, but it's not allowed. And I don't see anybody rallying to protect these students, okay, even though if you agree with the Confederate flag or not. And I could say the same with people who are wanting to say, they're called Holocaust deniers or anti-Semitic people who are critics of Israel or Zionist political ideology. They're shut down. The picket lines come. They'll shut the event down for public safety because they don't want anyone to get hurt. Okay. So you have free speech zones. If you criticize the government, you have to do it in a little box. I've been to events where they had a free speech zone. So that's America too. What about the Constitution there? It seems to be incredibly selectively, they want to cherry pick what is so-called valuable speech and what isn't. And I'm sorry, but defacing and inciting religious anger is not, to me, very constructive. Let's put it that way. And I don't think the framers of this Constitution had that situation in mind when they put those provisions in for us, for our generations in the future.
Well, I agree. I think we're in a very strange situation now that they've substituted Islam for communism as the great enemy of the West. It's really, they're setting up a religious war. Now, some think that there's a very tightly knit and coherent sort of party of neoconservatives and extreme Zionists who are behind this.
Yes.
The neocon war party. And Gordon Duff, who's coming in the second hour, definitely has that interpretation. He feels that the neocon Zionist war party has been pushed back a fair bit by the realists, that Obama sides with the realists, and that the best way to work this is to support the lesser evil, that is the realists against the neocons. Others argue that that's just another kind of divide and conquer strategy, that it's a deception. It gets us imagining that there's a real difference between Democrats and Republicans. What's your take on this?
Well, I think you have to look at Garland, Texas, as you do Hebdo, and any of these, some of these, but especially these two instances. You have to look at them and you have to say, for this to be pulled off in the perfect way that it was, and to get the political effect afterwards and to have the media all kind of going into lockstep on it and not questioning any of the anomalies of it and all that. You have to have people who are either working independently. So there has to be a privatized command structure that bleeds over into multiple agencies and organizations. So like you said, there has to be a sort of a fifth column within the whole matrix. And that would have to be some kind of bizarre alliance. I mean, I see Pamela Geller is over as a keynote speaker at neo-Nazi events in Europe. So you have a Zion, this beautiful marriage, this weird marriage of Zionism, extremist Zionism, and neo-Nazism. And it brings me to Andres Breivik as well in Norway. And I can see, wow, this is a good example of that as well. Here's Pamela Geller, exact same marriage, this inconvenient, strange, weird marriage that they somehow their interests have come together out of some common hate for Muslims or fear of Islam or fear of ISIS or whatever. So total manipulation, total whatever words we can use to describe it, but it's completely manipulated, contrived. These are dialectical constructs that they're, it's like a mix of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations and Admiral Mahan's, whatever geopolitical 19th century machinations combined with the Tea Party, right wing of the Tea Party combined with Benjamin Netanyahu. And, you know, so it's a strange kind of multi-headed beast that's appeared onto the scene. And that's what I see has happened in Garland. Someone had to go off the reservation.
Hear, hear. Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that the Zionists and the Nazis have come to resemble each other. Neoconservatism, founded by Leo Strauss, it was basically Strauss saying, if you can't beat the Nazis, join them. Well, hey, thank you, Patrick Henningsen. It's been great. I appreciate your excellent work at 21st Century Wire. We'll link that up at the radio blog. Just go to truthjihad.com and click on the radio blog. And I hope to have you back before too long.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Right. Take care. Welcome back to the second hour of Truth Jihad Radio here at Revolution Radio. Having a few computer hiccups here, but hopefully they'll stop hiccuping real quick. I'm Kevin Barrett. My website is truthjihad.com, where you can go to find the radio blog and find out about all of my radio shows. You can also subscribe and get all the shows quickly after they are recorded. So check it out, truthjihad.com. And while you're supporting good causes, don't forget to go to freedomslips.com, the website of Revolution Radio, and give generously. Revolution Radio, the greatest listener-supported network out there. All right, well, enough for the PSAs. Let's get down to business. My second-hour guest is Veterans Today's senior editor, Gordon Duff. Gordon Duff has been waging a one-man info war against the people who are telling us that Jade Helm, the military exercises that involve some kind of mock invasion of some southwestern states, is going to get us all locked up in Walmart. Gordon doesn't buy it, and this has led to a big battle of ideas, personalities, egos, I don't know. We're going to have to ask Gordon. Gordon, what do you think about all what's going on in the world today?
You mean that we have a few crazy people against the entire rest of the world, and that one of the first things to respond to is the mass defection from VT, and we went because I know you wanted to go there.
Let's go there.
You know, I ran into Stu probably in 2005. Now, I didn't run into Stu because I was in county jail with him or a mental hospital. I ran into Stu because I was the senior vice president of a merchant bank involved in litigation with MDC Corporation and KeyBank over a trade deal with Russia. And KeyBank had failed to produce a letter of credit for $2.2 billion based on a partnership agreement we had. They didn't have the assets for it. And so we sued them, along with the government of Russia. And I hadn't known anything about Milman and Mizell, that I excuse me for mentioning the names because it's like I want to cross myself when I say it. So I ran into Stu Webb and got his history with the family and whatever. And in the process, I got Stu's history, where he was genuinely screwed around in a specific way by having married into apparently a mob family. And I hadn't known that KeyBank was the mob. And I agree with him 100% on this. They're the mob. I spent 6 months litigating with these guys, and it was tough. And beyond that, I saw through his writings on the internet, and I didn't know him personally. I watched his personality fall apart. I watched him just go what I thought become unsound or unstable. I finally met the guy. It was only a couple of years ago, really, that I ran into Stu, and I've never met him personally. He was totally broke. He'd been injured in a traffic accident, which he said was a combination of Mossad and black helicopters, and that they hit him with a death ray of some kind.
That seems to have happened again recently.
I know. It happens all the time. I get it when I go to the store. It's either that or the reptilians. You know,
just watch out for them.
You're in the line. The person in front of you, 1 minute it's a woman, the next minute it's a man, the next minute it's a 9-foot-tall reptilian shapeshifter wanting to suck your brains out. You know, I have a lot of trouble with this, as do all of us, but I'm learning to overlook it. But what I'd learned about Stu, I'd agreed to help him. We have a law firm here in-house, and we'd agreed to represent Stu, and I can't say any more than that because of privilege. And we still represent Stu, by the way.
That must be kind of odd.
I don't. Not really. We represent murders and rapists, too. So, you know.
Wait a minute. So if Stu sues you for zapping him with a death ray delivered by a reptilian in a black helicopter, you're the one who's defending him?
Yes.
Okay, I guess I want to be in the courtroom when this one is tried.
Yeah, that'll work pretty well. I don't have a good sense of humor about some of this stuff. So some things that people think are civil turn very quickly to criminal charges, and they think they know the law well, and they don't. But literally, you know, I read what you wrote, and you had a pretty good grip on what was going on. My weakness, and it's yours too, you feel sorry for people. It's easier for me because I have more money and power, basically. And
you have more money and power than me?
Yeah, I do.
Well, we'll just have to see about that.
Yeah. Why, yes, they do, Kevin. Yes, they do. And, you know, it's that liberal guilt thing, you know, where you just, you know, he's doing terribly and life has been mean to him. And then he's a disabled veteran, you know, from the Marine Corps, except that when we tried to check on his military record, we couldn't find any signs of him having been in the U.S. military. And that's not a huge issue, and not the first time I ran into it. But, it's, you know, it isn't so much about Stu. You and I expect Stu to take on crazy stuff. We always have had the suspicion he's been an informant for maybe not the FBI, but some kind of police somewhere, and that he hangs around marginal people, you know. And when I brought him around VT, should you as an editor have kicked my ass, Kevin? Well, yes, you should have.
Well, I was concerned. You know, I've been on the radio with him a few times, and he occasionally kind of loses it a little bit. You bring up Ted Gunderson's name, and Stu starts raving. I mean, I don't know Ted Gunderson personally, but Stu's manner of going after Ted Gunderson always seemed a little unsavory and worrisome.
We have an FBI, you know, there's a retired FBI. We also have a contract with the FBI, you know, Cyber Crimes Division. We work with them. But I have a number of senior FBI people I work with that are, you know, these guys are not young. I mean, they're older than I am, and I'm a little older than you are. But and nobody loves Ted Gunderson. You know, these are guys that work for him, and they didn't, you know, say, hey, he's the greatest guy in the world.
But they're not saying he's a blood-sucking reptile.
No, that. And see, I'm getting all of this from not just Stu, And I ran a background check on Ted Gunderson just to be sure. And I found ex-FBI. They get out of the FBI. They you know, they're missing their desk. They look for attention. He had all of those things, and a lot of FBI people do this. And then he found causes, and he became religious and almost fanatical about them. But as far as him doing anything wrong, no.
Well, a lot of his causes were good causes, exposing the Franklin cover-up, stuff like that.
And the same thing, the same people went after DeCamp on the Franklin cover-up. And while working for an intelligence agency that I'd met working for, I was brought in by the Bush family to look at an issue of blackmail. Now, I had no evidence and, of course, was never given any, by the way, you know, welcome to that world, nor access to any kids or whatever. But I was made aware of a, you know, a blackmail attempt on George Herbert Walker Bush, and that it was an issue of national security. Now, I did not act against Mr. DeCamp. Matter of fact, I think I was less enthusiastic than people wanted me to be. You know, and cleaning up the mess. People thought they could come to an intelligence agent and maybe get me to do something to people. And it's not supposed to work that way. Not with me anyway, it doesn't. And plus my, you know, my life, as I grew up as the son of a Detroit auto worker, you know, and my belief in the supreme goodness of the Bush family has never been very strong, you know.
And I think it diminished over time, didn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Or rather, we should say your belief in the supreme evil of the Bush family has increased over time.
The issue is not so much is Stu. Stu has a difficult life. He doesn't have a lot of money. He lives with his dad. He has an injured back. I think he's suffering from a bipolar disorder. It's opinion, you know, a severe bipolar disorder, as do most. And persecution mania. He's highly delusional. And do I want to destroy Stu or whatever? Not really. And do I care what Stu says? Frankly, not really either. I kind of just don't care, you know. And with Fetzer, and this is the other thing. How this started and run around this, I had Robert O'Dowd has been an occasional writer on VT. He was a peacetime Marine Air Wing stationed in El Toro and has written articles consistently, mostly about environmental problems at El Toro. And that's been his one issue. You know, there's the little other things he hasn't cared a lot about.
Yeah, we don't see him that much at VT.
He's the go-to guy on that. That one little thing, nothing else, you know, and not an activist and not someone who generally cared. And he seemed to have gotten a bee in his bonnet, apparently, you know, unaware that InfoWars, we call it disinfo whores here, but that's because we're funny people, you know. But he'd suddenly decided he knew something about that and wanted to put up an article that I knew to be unsound. You cannot print total fabrications on VT. It's against the rules, you know, especially things that are meant to frighten people for no reason with fabricated bullshit. And I said, nope, you're not putting it here. You can put it somewhere else, but not on VT. Doesn't belong there. The next day, Fetzer called me up, and we talk all the time. I mean, I've been talking for years.
And let's point out, this is very rare, Gordon. I mean, I've been writing for VT for several years now, and at times I've gone astray from the editorial slant on various issues, and I haven't had a problem. Now, there have been a couple of people who haven't liked your editor's notes that I think you've done a couple of clumsy editors.
Yeah,
but overall, the editorial freedom at VT has been exemplary.
Well, editorial freedom, there's a difference between, and remember, VT in 2003 was a blog. We're a journal now. You have a PhD in something. I don't know what it is, but it's something anyway.
It's Arabic and Islamology. with a focus on folklore and Sufism. In
guys,
Morocco.
He's making that up entirely. Yeah, None of this is true.
Run a background check, Gordon.
you don't want to go there. You know better than that one.
Yeah. You probably find that guy that followed me all over Morocco. There was this ugly looking Moroccan guy, just hideous face, who spoke perfect English, who kept popping up everywhere I went in Morocco. And then he told me that I should.
You have pretty much an idea. You know who we have in Morocco and what we can do there.
Yeah. And I just recently learned that the guy who ran the Fulbright program there, whose name I won't mention, a Muslim convert and interested in Sufism. I kind of like the guy, actually. I'm told he was station chief while I was there.
Well, it would take two phone calls here and probably an hour. If you were talking to someone in Morocco, I could say, go answer your door. I don't hear anything. Wait a second. And said, do you have your toothbrush with you?
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I really do have a PhD, Gordon. So take it.
All right. We'll get into that later here. But with Fetzer anyway, he went a little ballistic, saying that you have no right to censor that. And I'm saying, well, yeah, everything he said he got from Alex Jones, David Hodge, Steve Quayle, and Dabu Seven, which is and my point being, and this is my discussion with Fetzer, these are Christian evangelists. They are Zionists, fanatic Zionists. They are creationists. Okay, these are who talk about angels continually. They have no standing or qualifications, military, intelligence, academic, all of them, including Jones, of any kind whatsoever. They have a continual agenda of promoting fear porn. They have never been correct on anything yet so far.
Wait a minute. Didn't Alex yap about the big terror event coming before 9/11? Of course, some people say that's because he knew it was coming, but I don't buy that.
Yeah. Do you have 40,000 Russian troops in your backyard? Did the Ugandan UN troops that he said were at Charles?
Yeah. Where does he come up with that stuff? Because, you know, I think some of Alex's work is okay. I mean, he's done, you know, he informs people about stuff like the 1953 coup in Iran that overthrew Mossadegh and stuff like that. But then he throws in this weird Ugandan troops invading your backyard stuff.
Kevin, why am I yelling at you now quietly? But why am I yelling at you? You work with intelligence agents. You've been to school for a long time. InfoWars, and it's not just them. There are people a lot smoother. InfoWars is, and, you know, frankly, I think they're funny. You know, if you don't, I mean, the female vitality formula alone, I was considering getting some of that, just trying that, see if I could just switch sides for a day, you know, because he's selling all this important stuff. But he has to be laughing when he does it, because the photos of him, the Mussolini photos, where he's got his chin up, you know, and they've airbrushed him away. I mean, the whole thing is kind of ludicrous. But
it's a shtick. But he has a good shtick.
Well, I think it's shtick. But the problem is that the discussion with Fetzer, and here's where we had this discussion about O'Dowd, and it's essentially that the thing, you know, they're the sign people have in their pools, you know, I don't swim in your toilet, don't pee in our pool. Well, Veterans Day is not, we had already dealt with Fetzer putting up the McCartney libel, and explain to the people what the McCartney libel's about.
Yeah. Well, this was a very entertaining show. I actually did a couple of shows with Jim about
this. And articles. He published articles.
Yeah. Jim is, he's convinced that Paul McCartney was replaced by a guy named Billy Shears, who has been false Paul McCartney ever since 1966. And when he introduced a story on No Lies Weekly News to this effect, that was actually just an entertainment story that was made up from a place that does, you know, goofball stories and basically just entertainment and satire. And Jim reported that as an actual news story. We had a little conflict about that. And so, you know, I hashed that out. But yeah, it's true that accusing Paul McCartney of being an imposter is accusing him of a crime, which is something that I wouldn't want to do unless I had better evidence. But
he's a British citizen, and you have an idea what their libel laws are like?
Yeah, so
you could ask John Anthony Hill about that, right?
So that means that next time Jim goes to London, he's going to get abducted and he'll be sharing a cell with Michael Shrimpton, probably, huh?
He can hope they didn't pay any attention because they'll extradite him.
Really?
And we'll do it. Yes. Oh, when we're talking about people in Britain, I'm very careful what I say. I work in London, and you know, and you can do so much stuff and get ignored because you're on the internet press or whatever. You hope to God they don't take you seriously.
So are you afraid that if you go to London because you're the senior editor at VT, that you could get in trouble because of Jim?
No, I'd sell him down the river in a minute, actually. I'd say, Fetzer did it. Go get him.
Oh, man. You have no loyalty, Gordon. Well, actually, this is the thing is – you know, how do you deal with these kinds of situations with, you know, somebody that you disagree with, you think is maybe off the wall on an issue, but he's done work that you really like on other issues?
Well, there's the question about this. I called him up. We talked, and we normally talk all the time, and I have to tune down crazy things he does all the time. I mean, that's, you know, and you've been through that one. We don't have to go there. He and I came to an agreement. I asked him what his sources were, and he said he went to Alex Jones. He went to Dabu 7. He went to Steve Quayle and Dave Hodge. And I said, have you vetted those sources? And he says, I don't have to. Because for all I need, they're sources. I'm saying, but I don't accept those sources. Not only that, they're the blood enemies of everything that the rest of us stand for at VT. I mean, they're the antithesis of us. These are rank amateurs. They're, you know, not just controlled opposition. These are by my standards, really bad people. And we run VT primarily to offer people a credible alternative to fear porn, idiocy, and this blogger crazy. And then when somebody brings it into VT, now this is the issue, and this is what he had decided he was going to do, that he believed in this because of them. And I said, well, you know, they're liars. So I don't care. I don't care if they're liars. I don't care. He told me he didn't care if what they said was true or if anything he said about Jade Helm was true because he likes the story.
Yeah. You know, I had that problem with the Paul McCartney issue too, that Jim didn't seem to have the kind of normal care that you would exercise about who's the source. And that's what he's telling me about Jade Helm too, is that it's not about whether the source is credible. It's just, there are all these dots and I want to connect them.
Meaning that he's using, in this case, he's taking the worst imaginable sources whatsoever. He's using Veterans Today's credibility. He's using his personal credibility as a McKnight professor emeritus in order to add credibility to what we know to be, and when we've long since discovered this to be, an obvious psyop that, according to the Democratic Party, comes out of the neocon Israeli nexus. You know, and we've all pretty much looked there. The Democratic Party certainly blames the Republicans for this one. But
well, let's talk a little bit about how that works, because you know, I'm, you know, two-thirds of the way there with you on this one, Gordon. That
Kevin, let me just finish you off here. I can just the coup de grace. I can reach into the black cabinet beside me. Okay, since you've been in my hovel that I work in, you know what I'm talking about, Kevin. So the idea of Jade Helm is that somebody was going to bring 1,200 American troops, special operations people, into Texas, and that was going to represent a threat against the state of Texas. Yes.
Yeah, that's one way they're selling it. Yeah.
How many U.S. troops are permanently stationed in Texas all the time?
Well, I read your article today, and as I recall, it was, like 750,000 or something ridiculous. No, not that many. But a lot of them.
85,000. Yeah. The organization that's stationed in Texas is called 3-Corps. Okay? 3-Corps is the most powerful, other than the United States, 3-Corps of the United States Army is the most powerful military force on Earth.
So, my God, it's worse than we thought. They've already invaded and occupied Texas.
Yep, it's too late, guys. And they came there. They started sneaking in 1870 to Fort Sam Houston. Then in 1872, they settled into Fort Bliss. And in 1942, they took over, and this is bad, Fort Hood, mind you. They did this, snuck in 1942, and that's, you know, before I was born, by a little bit anyway. And there are 29 other military bases. And the U.S. military, by the way, the Department of Defense, is the largest single employer in the state of Texas, okay? Texas has the most permanent troops stationed in it, and these units in Texas are special operations, multiple armored divisions, artillery, and infantry.
Sounds like this the militia doesn't have a chance.
It's the tip of the spear. This is the U.S. Army of Texas alone is more powerful than the Russian Army. No trouble at all. Could wipe China off the map in a minute. Could march through Europe like nothing. It is the largest.
Don't mess with Texas.
It's the largest single military force on Earth, and it's been there continually since 1942. And they're saying that 1,200 more people in the lunch line at Fort Hood wouldn't be noticed. Now, did I take you from 2/3 to 3/4?
Well, yeah, no, I'm with you on that part, but what I want to do is talk about the PSYOP, because I'm actually fairly, I think of myself as being fairly capable at understanding the PSYOP dimensions of things.
Did you catch my Neo article?
Geez, I'm trying to remember. I don't know. Oh, no, remind the listeners about it.
Oh, okay. Let me, I'll bring up the point, Senator. I'll read something from it. And you know how you hate me doing that, by the way. And this is NEO, Jade Helm, An Admission of Failure. And NEO is New Eastern Outlook, published in Russia by the Russian Academy of Science. And I'm going to just I've got a bullet point list. After careful analysis of the Army statements, cleaning away the fog and cobwebs, the doublespeak, this is what the world was told in a small Texas town. This was published on, it was written some time ago. The Russians are slow in translating stuff. And it was published on May 6th. Points. These are bullet points. Jade Helm is a simulation to teach the Army not to kill every civilian they see like they did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Point. Jade Helm will teach, they hope, a totally failed military to operate using human intelligence they might get by not alienating everyone in the world by acting like total fools and incompetents. Point. Jade Helm is supposed to teach special operations troops how to survive without PlayStations, 6,000-calorie lunches, and Mama Army 24/7. Point. Jade Helm units are going to learn to move undetected, pretend, and we mean pretend, to earn the trust of civilians who will be role players. I hope the cooperating locals are getting paid for this. Point.
they're going to have a harder time earning the trust of civilians after all of this.
Well, there's always that, you know. Point. Jade Helm is an attempt to sell a narrative that the defeats in Iraq and Afghanistan and the horrific failures that have left both nations a total disaster can be fixed. This, of course, is delusional. Point. Jade Helm is based on the hypothesis that if troops are trained to work around people better, they can get intelligence, get help from locals the way the Viet Cong and Taliban have done. This is unrealistic. Point. Jade Helm may well be training to fight in America under a Red Dawn scenario or even a civil war. I acknowledge that.
Now, and that's where we get into some, you know, serious disagreement. Like, that, should they be doing that? I mean, isn't there posi comitatus under zero circumstance? It would be better to let the country implode than to bring in the military.
Let me answer that. Tell me about the legal basis of posi comitatus.
Well, isn't it a basic blanket prohibition against federal troops?
No, it's actually
occupying or doing law enforcement within the borders.
It's actually kind of a mild suggestion, legally.
Well, I think it should be a blanket prohibition.
Oh, good. you should think that. It's just not true. Let me tell you about my own childhood here. In 1967, I was a college student living in Detroit, working for Western Electric, part of the phone company. Now, we had this, we'll call it a racial misunderstanding in 1967 in Detroit. I remember I was driving my, and I'll talk about cars here, my Shelby Mustang, by the way. I remember pulling off a beach road onto Grand River to head into Detroit and hitting a roadblock, okay? 101st Airborne in Detroit. Behind the roadblock was a tank, M46 or whatever they were using then. The U.S. Army, an entire division, 21,000 men, were landed in Detroit.
And right, taken but, you know, they killed Martin Luther King, too, as you know. It was a U.S. Army division.
Was like, that was later.
But, I mean, this is just because they do this stuff doesn't make it right.
But they do it. I mean,
But let's have a revolution against it. See, that's where I'm on the side of Jim and the other alarmists, is I say we need to rise up and have the Second American Revolution throw out the troops from everywhere, not just abroad, but in the U.S. as well. We need to get back to defend the borders, constitutional republic.
Kevin, Gordon's holding you upside down now. The blood's running to your head. And here's why. That's why you're with the alarmists. No, you're actually with a purposeful fabricationist who will lie to the people because he disrespects them and because he enjoys telling humorous stories and connecting dots more than he cares for the country, his publication, his own credentials, the truth. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, once I can't trust you, okay? And then I have to go back now. This is, and we're still in points here, but We'll brush the last three quickly. Jade Helm may be a prequel to American involvement in Ukraine. Point. Jade Helm, however, seems to be a busy work fix for a number of problems that have plagued the military that are not being addressed, like fighting the wrong wars against the wrong people for the wrong reasons. The last point, and this is like right out of things you write, sort of. Jade Helm, in the most direct terms, is an attempt to train in the art of charm offensive. And is it a failure?
It's already quite the failed charm offensive.
The other point, however, is whether the Army is stupid or not, they have the right to train in the U.S., and as many as 500,000 troops will be training across the United States, reservists, National Guard, and, you know, until not that many years ago, I used to get called out for these things. And, you know, getting into uniforms year after year got harder and harder, by the way. But summer camp somewhere, you know, you'd have to go camp or an operation, or if you're lucky, sent to the canal zone. But that's what the Army does every summer. Camp Grayling up in Michigan is almost an entire county. There'll be 50,000 troops up there. Every whore in the United States is going to be in Grayling, Michigan. So if any of you are listening out there, and I'm sure you probably are, remember the Michigan National Guard, the Wisconsin National Guard, the Illinois National Guard, and the Ohio National Guard want to see you, and we'll be supplying you with the dates and telling you where the best motels are. But
You know, Gordon, we hear you. I see people training all over the place. I was telling Jim this on False Flag Weekly News the other day that, you know, I saw people training in Spring Green, Wisconsin a few years ago. So, yeah, we know this. This is all. But, you know, I'd like to move on to what to me is the most interesting aspect of this, which is how this psyop works. You're saying that the people who are promoting the fear porn on this Jade Helm issue are working for a kind of neocon agenda, and I kind of sense that could be the case. To lay it out for us.
It's a general belief that here's where we're connecting dots here, and there's reason, because we know these individuals connect. We know the relationship, and this is, you know, we have a number of people who have been around Alex Jones and others for many years, and we can bring up a fairly good list. Kerry Cassidy, for instance, we have a lot of people at Veterans Day that we don't list on our page. You know, Duncan from Nexus is one of my good friends. And, you know, it was his organization that got Kerry Cassidy started, and she waded into this. She was brought in as 2006, 7, 8, funded by Nexus to begin a And UFO is a great subject, and I love discussing UFO things, and I have my own beliefs on this, which are carefully separated from things that I know, because I don't mix the two, or if I do, you better call me on it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the complaint, and this was something we had from Nexus, is that Kerry quickly moved from reporting on things to trolling around the internet for dot-connecting stuff, pretending it's all her own material, bringing on people who were known frauds, but entertaining. It's one thing, you know, going after the sci-fi crowd that's listening for spook stories about aliens creeping around their backyard, or who want to blame their headaches and disasters in life on mind control experiments.
Well, yeah, that was weird. You saw Kerry Cassidy's piece where she basically repeated these bizarre claims about the death rays and such, and then said that she woke up with a crick in her neck, and rather than blaming the pillow, she thought it was part of some operation.
Yeah, and
read this?
I mean, she's a total phony and lunatic, and she had worked as a secretary at the Jet Propulsion Labs at some point, you know, pushing the mail cart, and suddenly you become an expert on something. Everybody is an expert on something. Everybody is a CIA expert. And every time I hear one of these guys, and we have an old spy club, you know, I call people up. You ever hear of this person? You ever run into them? This story, that story. You ever hear of any of this? Nobody ever has. If you want to learn about people who talk about their heroic military service, go to, and it's a competing website, but military.com has a buddy finder, and you can just type their name in, and if they served in the military, as long as you have the name right, and you can put mine in, by the way, Gordon Duff, you'll find what state they came from.
Wait a minute, you're really named Gordon Duff?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think Stu Webb was making up alternate names for you.
Yeah, and I've had four or five passports with other names on them, sure. And I've had work names. Yeah, we all work under with work names. None of these things, and no one would know any of these. But it's all like, you know, the TV show stuff on the mainstream media shows like Blacklist and other stuff like that are really far more accurate than the alternative media. There's one called America. Have you seen, and you don't watch TV though, but American Odyssey.
You keep telling me to watch TV because it's all pretty authentic, or a lot. There are a lot of authentic portrayals.
Well,
of
this is scary because American Odyssey is about a young lady that was with an American, let's say, special operations team that was going after a terrorist group in Africa. And they recovered evidence that that American corporations were involved in false flag terrorism against the U.S. And so when they were leaving with that evidence, they were hit by a Hellfire missile. This one woman survived with the evidence. And Blackwater, or Blackwater equivalent, has been chasing her across Africa, murdering everyone. Mm-hmm. It's all pretty, and it's all pretty much Veterans Today stuff.
It sounds kind of plausible.
But we have a lot of shows like that. Blacklist goes this direction all the time, false flag terrorism. The bad guy in Blacklist is part of what they call the Cabal, and he's the head of the CIA, and he works with an organization out of Germany started by old line Nazis who steal nuclear weapons and use them in false flag terrorism. Have you ever heard any of this before?
I think I read this at VT.
Yeah.
Have you sued these guys for plagiarism?
You know, I was thinking we ought to rent stories to them, but you have a very good point actually. And it may well be worth it.
Well, just cut me in for a share of the proceeds, but you know, let me get back to the PSYOP angle because, you know, I always thought that it was actually kind of cool that these conservatives, you know, sometimes Christian conservatives, whether it's Ron Paul, who I really admire, Alex Jones, who I sort of am in awe of his performing ability, and, you know, people like that are actually kind of dividing and conquering the conservatives and screwing up the neocons. They're awakening people. Like, if you're basically a Fox News viewer, you're not going to even wake up the slightest bit unless, you know, if somebody like you or me or whoever else sort of more towards the left or the middle comes on. But if Alex Jones or Ron Paul maybe or some kind of conservative figure starts talking about some of these things, then they'll start to wake up. So frankly, Gordon, he's not a neocon operative. He's an anti-neocon operative. He's splitting, dividing, and conquering the right and messing with the neocons.
Kev, let me try to correct some of your
devil's advocacy.
More than that. When talking with the Syrians, now I have the Syrians on pretty much all day long. We've added a bureau in Damascus. We have several people that are working with us. One, the head of the Syrian Security Service, is working with VT. The Minister of Justice of Syria is a you know, VT source now. In Iraq, we just brought on for VT Iraq. Nouri Maliki has just come on VT.
Really?
And he has sent an article in, and that's sitting in war zone right now. And then I have an interview I did with him a couple of days ago that we're editing down. But the former prime minister, and I've got his picture with Obama here, and it's a great photo. Obama just wishes he was in another room of some kind. But and we're going to be setting up an Iraq trip. But while we're doing this, and then let me do a minor manic subject change. The Syrians came to me 3 nights ago with a claim that Turks had come into Syria, and they wanted me to tell the world. Okay, and then I said to them, rather than doing the Jim Fetzer, okay, and. And these are from real people who aren't known pathological liars, mind you. I asked them to prove it. And if you go into VT, you'll see the photographs of the Turkish troops they captured. They took the picture and sent it to me. Well, I'll believe that. 5 nights ago, they told me that a Turkish commando unit hit al-Nusra's headquarters. And they killed six Turks, senior officers. They found a chlorine gas.
The Syrians hit al-Nusra.
Yes. Yeah. The Syrians killed 31 al-Nusra commanders just 5 nights ago. Mm-hmm. And we have their report from Syrian intelligence up. And I asked them to prove it. And so they gave me the names of three of the Turkish dead. They captured three. They killed three. The three dead, we published their names. Mm-hmm. And no one's come out to call us a liar yet. So while people are just pulling stuff off the internet, whatever it is, no matter where it's from, no matter who invents it, no matter what it is, we're trying. And it's more and more important we do this because others are so horrific. We have to try. But here's kind of another point. The Syrians are very concerned. Now, I'll give you a medium scoop here. The Syrians came to me telling me that the Gulf Cooperation Council in the summit meeting in Raita, they're saying that Holland was brought down there and that he agreed to supply al-Nusra and ISIS with a French Mistral air defense system.
That's right. Yeah, I did see that.
Now, you know, I would still like more information on this. Now, they want the U.S. to have this information and to believe them, because if ISIS or al-Nusra is bringing this air defense system in, the chances are now – the upcoming battle that we're supposed to be looking at, remember the town of Mosul and how the U.S. had claimed they were going to attack Mosul in spring, this spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the one we're burning through right now.
Yeah.
Well, what if that French system were intended to be an iron dome over Mosul?
Mm-hmm.
To to eliminate U.S. air support for Pemersia and for the the Syrian militias, the Syrian army, and the 100,000 or so Iranians that are going to sneak across the border to help with us.
It's time for a shooting war with France.
It sounds like a shooting war with France. And then yesterday, the Saudis and Turks announced that they have developed a working relationship to supply al-Nusra with advanced weapons. And it's their, they have abandoned the U.S. position, turned their back on Obama, and they have decided to go full force against President Assad.
So it looks like they're Western power centers that are actually okaying this. I mean, Turkey isn't going to just start supplying al-Nusra unless somebody nods and winks.
And see, the Lebanese, Bouassad, and this is in the article you see, and this was the position he took. Or is there a bifurcated command system within the United States where President Obama is being just undermined entirely through the Arab world? And the Turks and Saudis believe they can just, piss on his parade like this. And what can he do about it? And he's done nothing about it. Now, if I were sending you the defense write-ups every morning, this was the discussion on the U.S. side of how the U.S. is going to deal with it and why they're not dealing with it clearly. Then Martin Dempsey, who's our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had made a number of non-specific statements about how the U.S. was backing a buffer, how he was prepared to back a buffer zone in Turkey. That's a fallback position, meaning Obama is on the ropes. Ash Carter, our new Secretary of Defense, and if you don't deal with these guys, this is a problem. He's not Hegel. The other point being, of course, that Dempsey has been pushed out and Dempsey is being replaced by someone we believe who will sit by and watch both Iraq and Syria fall. And if they fall, things will get fairly serious. Now, about 45 minutes ago, we published an article submitted from Syria claiming that if Turkey invades Syria, that Russia will retaliate against Turkey.
And that could get ugly.
August 1914, you're seeing it, yes?
Yeah.
Yes, and if I can head into that. But this is the business we're doing. While other people are worried about, heaven forbid, and I don't know, I think John Stewart probably has it all better than any of us, and he has the right amount of seriousness for Jade Helm. But while we're talking about these things, and yes, one of the things it could be, it's a distraction from, so much of the world is totally falling apart right now.
Yeah.
And yet the only dialogue we have is Jade Helm and other childish distractions.
But Gordon, there is a connection here, even if it's not a direct and real connection, but there's a kind of an indirect connection in that if we're on the verge of World War III and World War III breaks out, then I don't know about internment in Walmart, but basically all bets would be off as far as what life in the U.S. got like.
Well, my choice is to run around saying, like Chicken Little, or I can maintain my lines of communication with the Defense Department and with President Assad and with the Iraqis and
and try and do something productive about it.
And try to show the United States that the position they're taking, especially when it looks to you and I, there's little doubt about this, that Obama doesn't clearly have a grasp on what's going on much of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know who he's listening to.
So this is what we're doing collectively. And the issue I have here, and this is why, frankly, while we're doing all of these other things, we looked this week and it wasn't a workable situation, but the Iraqis tried to put us all on a boat, sail us in the middle of the Indian Ocean and abandon us. And you can tell people about that one if you want.
Yeah, right. Every time I go to a conference in Iran, they always wait till the day before to, tell me when I'm supposed to fly there and stuff and give me my visa. And now they're just like saying, here, can you get on a plane 2 hours from now and come to Iran to send us out, you know, go out into the Gulf and, you know, protest the massacre in Yemen. It sounds like the Mavi Marmara, except instead of, you know, trying to break into Gaza, we're trying to break into Yemen. So, you know, talk to Ken O'Keefe about how that went. And I was ready to go, but it turns out I
would have gone other than, you know, that I have several, you know, several pressing personal things here that you would say would override this.
Yeah. I had to stick around to host Gilad Atzmon, who's coming to Madison next Wednesday.
For instance, you know, but here's another rumor that's, and these are rumors that have foundation. We are told these things. We are told that the Saudis have underwritten, in order to get this air defense system, they've offered Hollande a blank check, whatever you want, in order to give ISIS an iron dome to shoot down American planes. And the U.S. is sitting on its ass. And I have challenged the Defense Department on this. I've gone to people saying, if al-Nusra has these rockets, if they've got a missile defense system, and this is a short to mid-range, meaning it'll work out 45 miles and up to 50,000 feet. These are not toys. That America will not be able to offer air support. And if we do not move on Mosul, if that keeps being put off and put off, President Obama is going to be pilloried for this, because that was his promise. Mosul in the spring. Well, it's May right now, not March. And Mosul is sitting there. Plus the taking of Tikrit, there was an awful lot of backbiting between the U.S. and Iran over this. And that relationship has become less and less smooth as the maniacs in Congress are trying to maintain sanctions on Iran. And while they're trying to do this, mind you, as you are well aware, the Indians have decided to go in anyway and build a port in Iran. The Germans have decided that all the sanctions are over and they're opening their doors. So those sanctions that Congress is pushing for will only be sanctions against American companies, and all of those jobs and all of that profit and all of that business from Iran is going to go to other people at the cost of American jobs, American revenue, and American prestige around the world.
And even when I was in Iran last fall, there were a whole bunch of German businessmen swarming around the hotel.
And half of them were Israelis, by the way.
But yeah, probably so.
Yeah. And instead of talking about these things, then let's take the second fallback that the Turks have, or that the Saudis have offered deals, and these deals go through Turkey, because Turkey is the Saudis' door into Iran. That we were told Iran had been approached about a deal for Yemen if they would develop a bit of a cold in dealing with Syria and Hezbollah. And we have confirmations inside Syria that the normal payments that the Assad government had been receiving stopped about 6 weeks ago. Because Iran's been paying the bills, as you may or may not know. Mm-hmm. But that money is stopped. And part of this, when I talk about intelligence, some of this is analysis and some of it is you have an endless list of stories, and it's like the things Fetzer deals with. But you have to sit and ask a question. Does this make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's one. I had a militia leader came in out of Aleppo talking about what the Turks were doing there, and I'm saying, you know, you've got a mobile phone with a camera in it. Give me a picture, or tell me when the Turks arrived. Tell me what road they were from. Tell me what vehicles they had. And eventually, after yelling at them on these sort of things, if you want to tell me something. Since everybody has a camera and everybody can put stuff up on Twitter, everybody do it. And heaven forbid they went out and got a couple of
pictures. Well, that's what people have been doing with renovations in Walmarts.
Yeah, they took pictures of them, you know, and so I've got photos of Turks sitting there. They look a little bruised and battered, mind you. you know, and I reminded people about the Geneva Convention. They said, well, we're Muslims and we don't need to be reminded about the Geneva Convention. Right, Kevin?
Yeah. Well, we are supposed to be humane to capture. Yeah, those guys didn't look like they were in great shape, though. But, Gordon, quick question. Why is the U.S. supporting the blockade on Yemen?
And this was why you and I would get on a boat if it were possible for us to do that, because that is an immoral act. The U.S. has no standing there. Whether President Hadi or not, whether he unresigned or not, the U.S. has no position.
Well, people are starving, and people are in bad shape. It's Gaza all over again.
And exactly. But the U.S. is actively involved in it as well. And this
But why?
If
the U.S. is more or less on the side of Iran, Iraq, and Syria versus al-Nusra and Turkey and Saudi, then why are we supporting Saudi in Yemen?
And some of that could be tied. Vesper, this is Gordon here. You're on the radio live right now, Vesper.
Hello, Vesper.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, that was our call-in. I was hoping for some call-ins, but I guess we finally got one at the very end.
Yeah, that was...
Well, I hear the music, Gordon, so we're going to have to save the... I guess everybody was intimidated. Nobody wanted to call in and give you a hard time, so...
Really?
They're probably afraid that if they crossed you, they would end up chained to the sporting goods aisle in Walmart when what hits the...
Or attacked by a Fetzer ray.
Watch out for those. All right. Well, thank you, Gordon Duff, senior editor at Veterans Today. Keep up the good work, and maybe I'll see you on a boat in the Gulf of Aqaba sometime, but not this week.
Well, we can put that off until it gets really, really hot.
Sounds good. Okay. This is Kevin Barrett, Truth Jihad Radio. Back next week with more incendiary radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside.